The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media. Give us feedback on this podcast or ask tech questions by calling the voicemail hotline at 877-414-5856. That's 877-414-5856 to get your questions answered.
I've recently become reacquainted with, through a mutual friend, an old friend from college. You know, I'd done a little bit of, you might remember I did the tech TV thing and radio thing, but many people don't know that the first film I ever starred in was a film about vampires and lawyers. And I played a thug. You imagine that? I played a thug. And the concept for this film was, I guess, I don't know how, it conceived. Is that, if that's the right word to use, I don't know how the hell it came about. I just remember watching it going, I understood it in such a way that I just shouldn't have understood it. And I think it's the easiest way to explain it. So Scott O, is the guy that I've known. Well, I've known of, I've known at least, but we just recently become reacquainted. I've known since 91.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And we've now, you moved here from Iowa. Maybe not directly, but you moved here to Seattle about 7 or 8 years ago.
Correct.
Why?
Well, mostly because I was really sick of the Midwest. So I was living in Chicago, and I lived in Chicago the summer that 600 people died in a heat wave. But then it's the same kind of situation in the winter where every year a certain percentage of people are killed by things that just fall off of skyscrapers, you know, ice and whatnot. So it just got to be too absurd. So I moved out here because my best friend from that theater program, and I've known him since grade school, had moved out here and was doing stuff out here. And a whole pod of our alumni from our theater program moved out here. So it seemed the thing to do at the time. And then I've just kind of stumbled into one technology job after another to pay the bills while doing crazy theater and video projects on the side to, you know, stay sane and whatnot. So the movie that you're referring to, the one that you starred in, was called The Cosmic Soup Catastrophe. And you were not a thug. You were a sidekick.
I was a sidekick.
To a superhero.
So I wasn't a thug. Okay. I thought I was a... I remember I had to wear a suit or a tie.
Yeah, they were very stylish. Yeah. I think they were modeled after the gang from Buckaroo Banzai, who always, you know, had a certain kind of style. But yeah, you guys run around fighting vampires and demons and whatnot.
And it was a toilet brush. Wasn't I holding onto a toilet brush?
So I haven't watched the tape in years. I remember it being an egg beater, but I think it could have been a plunger. I just don't remember.
I just remember holding onto some random object.
It's really funny because I was just telling Brady this the other day. You were in a bunch of scenes, and then this was a very climactic fight scene that had like 2/3 of the cast in one day, and you, for some reason, had a scheduling conflict, and I couldn't get around any other, so we just cut away to a shot of you to try to explain why you weren't there that day.
And it got a laugh.
It definitely got a laugh. Most things in that movie, people laugh because they didn't understand what they were looking at. So,
but you were supposed to, college days, you were supposed to be like way avant-garde.
It was pretty experimental, and I think back just running around with this gigantic VHS camcorder that, you know, weighed 4,000 pounds and trying to capture all this, and you know, everything that's changed between now and what people are capable of doing with even just cell phones these days is a little bit mind-boggling. But so there's some trained, you know, connections that go back to that and what we're doing now, which is a video series for the internet called Cherub, the Vampire with Bunny Slippers. And it's a parody of Joss Whedon's Angel, sort of a slapstick parody of that show. And it features a local actor named Basil Harris, who is, I don't know if you've heard of the band Awesome or the comedy group Bald Face Lie, but
I haven't.
At any rate,
is it a local band?
It is a local band. We got a whole passel of local fringe theater people who kind of just had the idea that it was time to get a little experimental, just like the old days for me. You know, you do theater in Seattle, you don't do it because you expect that you're going to get discovered or that you're going to, you know, not even necessarily make a huge living here. But what you do find then is actors who get really enthusiastic about far out ideas. And so this was a neat way. I pitched it to them. I've been an MP3 blogger for about a year and a half. So I was able to pitch it to them under the notion of, well, we might actually find an audience now. There's different kinds of discovery for content online, even than just when I, you know, 5 years ago, things are dramatically different. So
have you found that to be helpful to your creative juices, or at least kind of like one less reason that you would not do something?
Well, it's, you know, you always look at whether or not the work itself is going to be interesting, but the tantalizing idea that you might find an audience is around the corner for a lot of fringe artists, and it remains around the corner for a lot of fringe artists. And so even you know, we've posted two episodes now, and the third episode goes up tomorrow. And just the limited, I mean, we've only had, you know, maybe 20,000 downloads, but that's still, compared to an entire theater company's 5 years of seats that they might have sold, that's pretty significant. And so trying to build an audience online like that suddenly makes the work that you have to put in seem worth it.
So this, it's an angel parody.
Correct, yeah. One of the moderators on Whedon-esque, Simon, called it The Naked Gun Meets Angel with a lot of gin. And I thought that was an apt description. It kind of describes the series and what I would want my life to be like if I
could
do that.
So you've been doing, in between the times of, what was it, the Cosmic Suit Catastrophe, mm-hmm. and now, you've been doing other projects.
Yeah, a lot of short film and DVD projects. And
For yourself or for other people?
Both, okay. Combination in a variety of roles, whether writing or acting or directing or producing. I had a startup in the right as the bubble was starting to collapse that was basically hoping to be an internet entertainment destination where we would do streaming episodic video content. And it turned out to be a terrible idea for a wide range of reasons.
If you would have timed it today, I mean...
Exactly. And that thought crosses my mind all the time, just in terms of, you know, back in those days, bandwidth was a premium service and not this total commodity. And you did have to be a certain kind of web monkey to push content. And now you have these pretty easy publishing systems, so even idiots like me can get out and push stuff. And the penetration of broadband was pretty lacking. And then there was the fact that I was an ambitious, artistic, you know, inexperienced Yahoo in his late 20s who shouldn't have been entrusted with large sums of other people's money to try to run a business. Getting a degree in theater doesn't translate to business know-how. So right now I'm at the level where somebody else is running the business and I'm just the content creator kind of trying to push ideas out. But
So this project, again, where is it on the web?
It is at cautionzero.net/cherub, and we're doing 12 episodes in our first season.
Season, so you guys are...
Well, yeah, we would like to think of it as, you know, they're not short films. It's definitely, I'm very interested in episodic storytelling on the net, and part of the democratization of media publishing involves the fact that it's currently the case that you have an independent film tier and a major film tier, and you don't have that in television per se. I don't think anyone would consider public access to qualify because of its inherently limited scope. And so,
well, I don't know. A lot of video blogs that I've seen, it makes public access look like HBO.
Well, that gets to one of the problems, which is discovery of quality stuff and how and where you look for content still remains a problem, because once you open up the door to say, and the internet has always been this way, anyone can publish. Well, that doesn't mean that you will be able to easily find the good stuff that's getting published, or, to be less elitist, the stuff that you're just looking for, you know, the stuff that you're interested in. So,
like the Numa Numa guy, you know. Like
exactly.
Dancing in front of a webcam thing.
Exactly. And I mean, that's there's obviously an audience for it, or YouTube wouldn't be as popular as it is. You know, you can see the crazy kids, you know, getting 50,000 views of a video that it took them 5 seconds to shoot and put online. So that's one tier of it. I mean, that's a pretty fantastic thing. People are interested in that. But video blogging, as you say, YouTube isn't necessarily video blogging. We're publishing in a video blog format to try to encourage a small amount of community if we can, and to also participate in the way media is being syndicated. As opposed to, say, you know, there was a discussion on the video blogging list about whether or not the NBC Olympics coverage on the net constituted that kind of video blogging, and it seems obvious to some people, but it's really not obvious to other people, that just putting video on the net doesn't constitute video blogging. And to a more granular point, does the end user actually care half the time? But that's all sort of the swirling context for the...
What's your take on that? Was that video blogging? And
I think
does the user care?
Yeah, I think you can get to a pretty raw definition that just says, if you're not publishing in a blog format where you've got commenting and some syndication, that, you know,
it doesn't
matter, and that you wouldn't call it video blogging. But half the time, a user, if it's quality content, doesn't care. And the best example I can actually give you is my favorite site on the net right now for internet video is channel101.com. So it's a Los Angeles-based group that does. They have a monthly live event where a screening committee chooses amongst 5 potential pilots. They bring them in front of a live, or like 5 to 10 or whatever, some number, and they pitch these pilots to an audience, and the audience votes, and the top five vote getters get to make a second episode and whatnot and come back. Eventually, series get canceled by the audience. They don't, because they're just not popular. And so you have this ecology of artists down there who are just having a great time trying to push episodic storytelling to their friends in LA. And they put it up online. You can't vote online, but you can watch these series online. And it's not in a video blog format, but there's a community. They've got forums. And I don't actually necessarily care that it's in a blog or not in a blog. What I care about is that this is a really good series, and I trust the umbrella of Channel 101 to bring me a lot of really entertaining stuff. The Lonely Island guys got their start, or did a lot of stuff there. They did a parody of the OC called The Boo that ran for 11 episodes before it got canceled. And because they're in LA, they can occasionally do stunt casting, like have Sarah Silverman come in and be on one of their little shows, or Drew Carey, or yeah. Jack Black, and that kind of stuff. But the frustration that I have with Channel 101 is, of course, really good stuff can get canceled. And what we're trying to do with Caution Zero Network is give things a bit more of an opportunity to kind of get legs underneath them. Angel's a classic example of a show that was not very good in the beginning and got dramatically better the longer it had a chance to try to find an audience and get its legs under it. And so,
you know, one of the things that I'm super pissed off about is Arrested Development.
Yeah.
This is my opinion. One of the better acted shows and better written shows that was on television, in my humble opinion. In my opinion, genius. Absolutely genius. And they just
whacked
nixed it.
Yep.
It really was upsetting. Completely upsetting. So in doing this, is this a first project for this, your web entity?
Yeah, this is the pilot project for the network. And so Stephen McCandless is the managing director of Annex Theater locally, which is one of the longest lived fringe theater companies in Seattle. It's done a ton of great stuff. And so his idea was that, I came to him all fanatical about let's do this project. I want to make episodic stuff. I think it was the day they announced the iPod video. I just sort of had this flash of, why can't we just, now's the time, even though I had that idea 10 years ago and it wasn't the time, I thought, well, let's try it again. And I was doing a play with 17 other people at the time. So we rapidly backstage started churning out ideas. And one of the ideas that I had was, I'm a big fan of SCTV. I was very influenced by it growing up. And I think Cherub is very much in that style of slapstick parody. But part of SCTV's charm was that you had individual show parodies and then you had the network parody. You take a meta step back. And I thought we should do something like that. And Stephen interpreted that idea a little differently and said, let's actually have that kind of network and try to give fringe artists in the city, in Seattle, who don't have any opportunity to connect and network the way people do in Los Angeles, an opportunity to do compelling video work and try to actually find an audience using some of the discovery technologies that are out there. So we'll see what happens.
So you're not going to invite me on to do a cameo of holding onto an egg beater or a plunger or a toilet?
We should definitely talk.
Like a frame. So like it blips by like a cigarette burn, just like it's there and it's gone and no one knows it even happened.
Before we had even made arrangements to come on here, it hadn't even occurred to me. There's a scene in episode 12 of Cherub, the season finale, that I lifted the major structure directly from the fight scene in Cosmic Soup Catastrophe that I was just describing to you. And we were talking about trying to do a local screening. We're actually obligated to do a local screening because of our contract with the Screen Actors Guild for one of our actors. And so we were going to show as a special feature that scene and then it occurred to me, and Chris Brillo's in it for about 10 seconds.
Barely.
No one will know. But
Flash.
Yeah, so those were definitely interesting days. But I think my sense of humor hasn't changed that much. I just think I can do a lot more coherent storytelling as you get older and more experienced.
It's the same way with anything that you've done for such a long time that's in your blood. It's just over time it's going to get a little more natural translate that.
And
way.
The tools are getting easier to work with, and so there's just that sense of gradually getting more experience. But, I mean, we're all just a bunch of crazy people, it's...
How many people? I mean,
The cast probably has about 15. There were probably about 10 other crew members. We still have... an editor in Seattle and an editor in New York City. We have an IT guy who does our encoding and blog management and making sure that we're streaming properly. So all told, it's probably about 25 people who worked on it. And I mean, put in a ton of time for something that's relatively silly. And the the response has been pretty, two-thirds of the people who have responded have been, this is fantastic and hilarious, and we, you know, thank you for doing this. And then the other third has kind of been this stark sort of, I think when Guy on Metafilter said art is dead when he was exposed to the very idea of the show. And that, I think, is true when you think about the Zucker Brothers style of comedy. Like, you either dug that or you didn't dig it. There wasn't a lot of room for, you know, Top Secret's either your thing or it isn't, and so on. So we're definitely not making any pretense at being highbrow. This is very just off the wall comedy, but some of the people in the cast, including our main actor, are really talented sketch comedians and really talented actors, and so they're bringing a lot to the table, I think.
What was the name? And I since I wasn't here, I don't know, but there was I don't know if it was a sketch comedy troupe that ran almost, what was it called? Almost Live?
That was on one of the local networks.
Yeah.
It's been canceled.
It's gone, yeah.
And I never got a chance to see it. And my understanding from everybody that I've talked to is that it was really pretty horrible.
Really?
But that's just me repeating secondhand.
Well, I know
which
that.
I'm happy to do.
Well, Bill Nye got a start with it, as well as the guy who's now doing Talk Soup, or what do they call it? The Soup on E. It's just interesting.
Yeah,
what?
And in fact, they did a reunion show recently, and apparently Bill Nye, again, this is secondhand, got roped into doing it and looked pretty shell-shocked about the experience. Like, he's gone on and developed a career that's pretty...
Transcended the Seattle roots. Do you find that to be the case with a lot of stuff that's happening in Seattle, with music and art and theater?
Well, music is obviously the one area where Seattle's always been a kind of bellwether for the nation, and to some extent, or at least for the last 10 or 15 years or whatnot.
Yeah, as soon as grunge hit, bam.
I mean, well, not just grunge. I think the Decibel Festival has put Seattle on the map for being, it's kind of the Coachella for electronica, and they've done that for 2 years now, and it's exploded in terms of awareness by hooking up just some fantastic talent and getting it to play at Chop Suey and Numo's and rounding up a lot of really intelligent commentary around it. And that's actually something that I'm looking forward to blogging from next year. But in terms of theater, you definitely, with the exception of the way the Fifth Avenue is kind of like, you know, where they did Hairspray the musical first and then shipped it to Broadway, and then they tried to do that. They're going to try to do it with The Wedding Singer.
Yeah, I heard about that. Shipping. Yeah.
So there's a little bit of that starting. We had, obviously August Wilson lived here, and a couple of other playwrights of note have lived here. But in terms of trying to make it as an actor, you would have better luck being in Vancouver right now than you would being in Seattle if that was what you wanted your career to be, at least in film and movies. And that's, you know, there's always exceptions. Miranda July just had some success with a feature film at Sundance. And the Charles Mudaig from The Stranger had a film at Sundance. And so it would be really nice if we were suddenly able to curate, a little scene started to develop here. I think that's what they're hoping. I don't know if you've ever seen anything down at the Northwest Film Forum, but it's sort of a nonprofit arts group for film and video. We actually rented audio gear from them for Cherub. It's a great way to inexpensively get really professional gear. And I mean, super inexpensive compared to going down to a pro shop if you were doing commercials or whatnot.
Like, so it's high quality, what you've put together.
The gear that we used was, you know, the camera was a really, as nice of a prosumer camera as you could probably expect. We had professional audio gear. We had decent, very decent lighting. We shot on a private sound stage, so we controlled the environment to some extent. And, so the product, and then, you know, we have an editor in New York City who's, I mean, editing, digital editing tools right now, everybody knows Final Cut Pro or Avid, it doesn't really matter, but you can do really fantastic stuff, special effects and whatnot. So from soup to nuts, we've kind of got the whole...
Well, you're getting a good response, somewhat.
So far.
How do you gauge your success? So how do you know that it's going to be worth doing a second season?
That's a really fundamental sort of question that we're wrestling with already, because if we want to do a season two, we have to start planning for it now so that we can, you know, time it properly. And I think if Steven were here, the business guy for Caution Zero, he'd have a different answer than I do, because he has a clear and present need to sort of figure out how you're going to monetize it. And I think a lot of people in the video blogging industry are looking at that. And there are a range of potential answers to that question. But in the meantime, I had said from the beginning, even if Cherub attracts a pretty significant audience, it will still be the loss leader for the network. It'll be, this is how we demonstrate that we're capable of pushing out quality content, and it will be some future project after mine that comes along and kind of...
In a serialized manner.
Yeah. Because, I mean, we do want to add more series to the network as resources allow, and ideally we wouldn't be shooting them all ourselves. Ideally we'd be getting, you know, we'd be soliciting some of those.
Largely Seattle-based, or you just kind of, you would open it up to anybody out there who's thinking about attacking something like this?
I think for the shows that Caution Zero is going to produce itself, they would be locally based, but we, I would be happy to hear from other, especially like we thought about going to Channel 101 and looking at some of the fantastic canceled shows that they've been, that are sitting up there in their archives and saying, well, would you be interested in doing a few more of these for us? But that's a little speculative.
You know what I would love? Have you seen, you probably haven't, maybe you have, the IT, what is it, the IT gang, the IT crowd is what it's called on the BBC. You can only get it illegally.
Right. They've been talking about that a lot on Boing Boing, right? That's the one where they had to crack.
I've been downloading it by BitTorrent. I have no problem in saying that. It's a fantastic show. It's an amazing show, and I wish they would have something like that here. And is that, you know, what you'd be hoping to, not necessarily attract, but give people all that much more reason to try to do?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay.
I think there's just a scale difference between, my understanding is the IT show, I haven't watched it yet, is actually airing somewhere. So it had, you know, a more significant budget behind it. And so we're not going to be any substitute for the network's level of support for a production company if what you're trying to do is break into that business, obviously. We're just kind of pitching it as an alternative. If you're not living in LA and you're not pushing spec scripts and you want to really try to get an audience in some unconventional fashion, this might be the way to do it. And before the success of Rocket Boom, I don't think anyone would have believed that you could actually turn that into a real business, and now people are having second thoughts about that. And
it's funny how that works, huh?
It is funny how that works. But I think we're not hoping that, I don't have any expectation of achieving that level of success, but we wouldn't, the bar's a lot lower based on what we're trying to do. And so you have...
Maybe that's a good saying, actually. The bar is actually lower. You mean, don't raise any expectations.
Just... Well, right. I mean, the thing about it is, so, you know, comparing yourself to Rocket Boom isn't necessarily, like, especially in our case, we're trying to do something very different. Rocket Boom is... At its roots, it's a talking head show, and certainly they have field correspondents and whatnot, but that's what it is, and it's the cleverness of the voice and the intelligence of the writing that bring you back. They're not doing, long, complicated story arcs, and so that we're just, it's comparing apples to oranges in some extent. Just because we're all doing video on the internet doesn't mean it's going to be the same business for us as it is for them. We're going to have different kinds of distribution options than they are or not, and that's where it's kind of premature to tell what's going to happen, but building a network of shows that have a similar voice, I think, is important. It's similar to why you would follow, you know, record labels, for instance. As much as you might hate the recording industry, the fact is certain record labels, at least for my purposes, I'll buy something on a label that I trust if I haven't heard the artist. And I think that's true with Channel 101. I will go there and I'm much more willing to browse on Channel 101 than on YouTube, just, you know, surfing by tag and hoping that I stumble across something. I find YouTube to be more of a swamp. It's not as, for discovery purposes, I don't get what I want as fast as I'm, versus the time that I'm going to invest. And I know that's not true for everybody, so I'm not trying to slam YouTube. They're doing a wonderful thing. It's just, there's a whole different range of options.
What's the end game for you? Where do you want to be? Ideally, you know, whether it's a year down the road, 5 years down the road.
Well, so that's something from my startup days where, you know, I had lofty ambitions and then got them smashed. And so I try not to think that way
anymore. As did we all.
Well, not everybody. There's a few people who didn't have to worry about that. But, you know, so I had been dreaming that someday this would be an opportunity, if nothing else, for me personally to find an agent, let's say. And even that, I think, is really pushing the envelope of what my expectations ought to be. So right now, what I'm thinking is, let's take the opportunity to do season two, continue trying to build an audience, and just take it a step at a time, and not worry about the 5-year plan, because it's so, everything changes so fast, you know, with this kind of distribution and with this kind of content. So I'd love to see Caution Zero Network be a sort of a premier destination site. More importantly, I think, to me, just love to see Cherub find its audience and have people coming back for a third and a fourth season. That would be a different kind of creative reward than investing a lot of money and putting up a play that we can only run for 2 weekends in town and it goes away forever. There's a different kind of satisfaction as an artist to what you would accomplish here.
Have you thought about broadcasting plays?
Yeah, it's... I have a bias against broadcasting plays unless they're going to be shot really professionally.
Yeah.
So,
like multiple cameras.
Yeah, a real three-camera shoot. And that most fringe theater companies are at the limits of their resources just trying to put on the show, let alone trying to staff it with a video crew. That said, there are certain festivals that I think would be, Brady and I were just talking about this actually, certain festivals in town that would be ripe for short play festivals in particular that you could turn into episodes pretty easily. So that's something that we could definitely explore. I don't want to rule anything out, but I think people have, you know, limited attention for that sort of camera in the back of the room type of stuff. But
depends on the, depends on what it is. Like, I wouldn't suffer through waiting for Godot.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
I would have changed the channel like 5 minutes into it. I'm done.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. I just felt, at least for that play, in the audience,
Well, and that's the thing, too. One of the concepts that we operated on with Cherub, these are 4 to 7 minute episodes, and one of the underlying principles was you wanted to aim for short on the net. That someone who's surfing for stuff to watch at work isn't going to want to get involved in a 2-hour piece. And I think that's probably true. But so stretching it out over that's one of the reasons we wanted to go episodic is so that we can at least go ahead and still try to tell a long story, but not have to shove it down your throat all in one sitting.
So how'd you meet Brady?
I should squeeze this in. I've been to Burning Man 6 times.
Oh,
and
boy.
I thought I'd just, before Brady had the opportunity to bring it up.
Stealing my thunder.
Yeah. No, we have a bunch of mutual friends in this city, and I don't even remember which ones introduced us, but there are so many interlocking circles of artists and technologists, and we all kind of have multiple hats, and so it seemed pretty inevitable. But we've known each other for probably 4 years at least.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Brady is, I'm going to let him tell you a little more about it, but he's kind of been he's been getting me educated about, I keep using the phrase, these discovery methods, whether a lot of it's going to seem really fundamental to you, but I focus on just kind of being an artist, and it wasn't fundamental to me, the idea of all of the different ways we could try to use technology to get this series out there and to get the word out. Something as fundamental as just trying to put Technorati tags in the post, right? Like, I've been an MP3 blogger for 1.5 years and never bothered with that because people were finding it anyway, and I don't know how they find my MP3 blog. But
wait, you mean you post about MP3s or you post MP3s?
Post MP3s.
Okay, yeah. Your own or?
No, other people's. Okay. Yeah, it's part of it's a pretty interesting movement. It's, I wouldn't call it a gray area. It's pretty illegal to post other people's copyrighted material. Everybody knows that, but the whole MP3 blog movement for 3 years now has been getting away with, you post a track or two from an album and you only host it for a couple weeks and you wrap it in some kind of promotional blather that you provide, and then you put a buy to link to Amazon or wherever it's going to be. And that's gotten to the point where labels are now pitching me with stuff that they want me to put up. Right. And they understand the context, or they're leaving me comments that say thanks for, you know, pushing our band. But just turning on the blog and starting to publish, people found out about it, and I wasn't even paying attention to that, and I wanted to take a more proactive approach with Cherub. So
where's that blog at?
That's at comfortradio.org, and we post 5 times a week, which is a pretty rigorous schedule, so I actually try not to... I don't talk very much. I just try to let you hear the music.
Well, and you started out with our Burning Man music server.
Yeah, so we actually dragged streaming servers to Burning Man a couple times. The second time we were there, somebody else had dragged an FM transmitter out, so we were actually able to connect the streaming server and get the whole camp listening in their little boom boxes and whatnot. But that was what got me to believe that there was actually a potential audience out there. Like, if I didn't do any promotional work whatsoever, and 1.5 years later, I'm sort of a solid B- list MP3 blogger. Like, I don't get mentioned when Newsweek decides they want to write their quarterly article on, hey, is this cool new thing? But I, just judging by the audience response, we know that there's people who are loyal and whatnot. So already, I think Cherub, because we have the sort of Joss Whedon connection, has a potential to find a bigger or a different audience, and the response has been much more immediate. But we've also been working harder, which Brady can attest to. So
Brady, you're kind of the geek brains behind the brawn?
No, I've just been coordinating a lot of our activity on, like, Technorati, Dig, Video Bomb.
Yeah, I just learned about Video Bomb. What is it? Democracy
in Action.
In Action. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great site.
Yeah,
the Dig style sites are really taking off these days.
Yeah,
and so just getting us out there, making sure we were in all the search engines, from the start, getting the tags right, putting us in Delicious from the start. And then I also Devil Stick. And
yeah, he makes an appearance as Ralphie Dingleberry in an upcoming episode.
Yeah, it's how I fight vampires with juggling tools.
Oh, boy. So is there a cherub trading card game coming up here?
We haven't reached the point where merchandising is something we can...
Is that when it jumps the shark, honestly? Is that when you...
We'd actually been talking about trying to do an episode where we specifically jump the shark, and that would be a second season effort if we got around to it.
Where are we going to Second Life?
Yeah, we were considering shooting a whole episode in Second Life in our next season and having Cherub get excited about jumping a shark over a tank because he's in a virtual world and he can do it.
We'll probably be doing showings in Second Life.
We're definitely going to do screenings there.
Yeah. That so PT opened up Make to us.
What do you guys think about Second Life? I'm still trying to get my head around it. Neat, but it's a chat room. I mean, I was doing this stuff, was it the Palace, like years ago? I was still at you and I when I knew about the Palace years ago. Do you have like any particular takes on it? I mean, you've obviously talked about it. You know about it.
So to me, I'll just give a quick reaction to it. I thought it was pretty, on this one level, pretty mind-blowing in terms of what the artistic opportunities were there. So I'm not a gamer per se, and I was actually initially attracted to the idea that there wasn't a point or a plot that you kind of created it. And what I got fascinated by were all of the different structures that people had built and the ways that people imagined their environments. But I was looking at it from the perspective of how can I make art there right from the get-go. That was how I was introduced to it. So I don't know what it's like to spend time on that environment.
Through PT and Beth.
Yeah. Beth Goza came and gave us a demo of it because we were talking about doing a Machina film there. And so she took us on a tour.
To your little group or?
To Scotto, Lou, who's our IT guy, and myself.
And the reason why I ask is because your other hat, your official hat, is with MSN.
Yes.
So that's how we know each other.
Yes, that's how we met.
So I know you two individually differently.
Yeah.
It's just kind of weird. There's a triangle thing going on here, and I just don't know how comfortable I am talking about it. So
the thing I find most fascinating is kind of their user rights model. So users can go in there and create their own content. They own all the rights. People have launched games there. There are architecture firms in there that are doing conceptual houses. And I just think that's awesome. People make their whole... I don't know if it's their whole living, but people make livings just building Second Life clothing. And they own all the rights to it. And that's what I find most fascinating about it. And the houses that we were getting tours of were great. Beth took us up to like her secret shack where she had fire, and then she ate popcorn, and this... Cool.
It just blows me away. Maybe it's just so open. I just don't get it. And I mean, it's cool and it's interesting. And I love how the fact you could develop for it. You need to do your own thing. You could buy space or servers.
You can buy an island and sell it off.
But to your point, I mean, some people, I used to spend a ton of time in chat rooms. Now I don't do that anymore because I have different social outlets. And I think Second Life, if you want a really artistic social outlet, that's a great one. I mean, who didn't get kind of excited by the Snow Crash idea of the avatars as this kind of really serious alternate world? And they're kind of pioneering in that area to what I could tell, So you either have a need to socialize like that or you don't, but the technology is really impressive.
And if you can create your own goal. In Second Life.
Your own goal?
Yeah. You want to have a building. You want to make a game. You want to film a movie or show a movie.
Okay. See, maybe this is where I'm getting the disconnect. I'm so busy in my own life, in my own social life, my own stuff that I just barely have enough time for right now that I couldn't even begin to imagine trying to create or recreate that online. I just couldn't. If I had more time on my hands, I could see this happening easily.
That's true, though, I mean, of a lot of different phenomena. Like, right now, I'm a video blogger who really doesn't look at any video blogs because I don't have time to watch video. Like, when I'm at work, I can't watch video. When I'm at home, I'm either busy doing work,
producer.
My own work, or hanging out with my wife and spending time with my friends. And so I did a lot of research when I was getting ready to come on the show to find out what was out there, and it was actually really frustrating. You can spend a lot of time before you find... really high caliber video blogs right now.
You actually bothered to listen to something that we did?
I did listen to a few of your shows. I wanted to make sure I understood the context before
But there is no context.
That's
for the
what
show.
I learned. That's exactly. What made me comfortable about coming on. I wasn't sure whether I could expect crossfire.
No,
or what it
dear,
was gonna
God.
Be, so.
Dear God. Dear God. The closest thing we ever came to crossfire was an interview we did actually at the first SES we went to in New York about a year ago with an ex-spammer known as Todd Friesen.
Oilman.
Oilman. And so I was sitting there interviewing an ex-spammer. I had plenty of opportunities to kick him in places that could have gotten me arrested, I'm sure. And I didn't. But it ended up being a pretty compelling interview, and it ended up getting a lot of traffic and a lot of buzz. That was the closest thing we ever came to it. And I was still a nice guy to Todd, and I can I still don't know where he sits in the whole white hat, black hat, search engine stuff. But he's probably the person that I've grilled the most, and I came across like a pussycat, I'm sure.
Gotcha.
So yeah, I'm harmless, completely harmless. Well, and that's really the difference between what you find with you said like a talking hat video blogger or a lot of podcasters out there will pontificate on their own, and I find it much more compelling to listen to conversations that flow from one point to another and have a structure, but not necessarily a rigid in a certain set. This is what it is, and this is what it's about. Mm-hmm. It's just much more interesting to find, where a conversation leads.
Yeah.
So who knows where this one's going? I don't know.
I have no idea.
Damn. Mm-hmm. I was hoping you would, because I'm just like, I'm completely gone. So out of all the people from you and I, how many do you guess are here right now from the old theater troupe that you ran with?
There's probably about 10 people, maybe a little less now, but I think I'm not going to name names, but I can easily think of at least 7 or 8. Hmm. And a couple of them have done really well for themselves in town.
In theater?
Yeah. Actually, this might be worth mentioning. John Kaufman's here, and he spent a lot of time working at Pacific Science Center in the Planetarium, and he and a local musician wound up developing a show that took place in the Planetarium, and made use of that giant ball technology. They called the show Starball, and developed the premises. The audience comes in and sits down, and they take ideas from the audience in certain ways, and then they craft mythology and use star patterns to kind of invent the show on the fly. And they toured this to a bunch of planetariums nationally, and apparently the reaction ranged from this is quite a damn nifty thing to, you have these old school, I guess there are old school planetarium moderators who just sat with this kind of grim look on their face, like, what have you done with our precious Starball? So, but I mean,
you don't know Taurus anymore, I tell you.
Exactly. He has done a lot of interesting things here in town. And,
I barely remember names. I remember faces, though. Now, Brady, have you ever been involved with theater?
I was in Fiddler on the Roof.
Really?
In high school? I was in the chorus.
Oh.
I was a bottle dancer in Fiddler on the Roof.
And I saw that. Well, not in high school. I saw you and I did a production of Fiddler.
You're kidding. Oh.
They did a really good job. They did a really good job.
Wow. I missed out.
I've been wanting to be in one of Scotto's productions for a while. And we did a Serenity marathon where we did readings from one of the scripts.
Oh, that's right.
I couldn't make it.
What we did was to celebrate the coming of the movie, we showed all 14 episodes of Firefly, and then in the middle we had found an unshot, there's a script floating around that they didn't shoot that was written by one of the staff writers, and so we cast a bunch of people and did a stage reading of it.
Did you film that?
No, we sure did.
Oh, come on! Come on!
We may be obsessed, but we're not quite that obsessed.
Oh, dude, that's totally Numa Numa guy stuff. That's the kind of thing that people want to see again and again and again.
Fair enough. Well, somebody did a parody of Firefly that they called Mosquito, and they just had fantastic effects they did a parody of the opening credit sequence with actual CGI and everything, but then spent the rest of the short film doing it kind of mockumentary, Spinal Tap style backstage with the crew of Mosquito, and it became a little less interesting at that point. But just seeing the CGI and thinking to myself, I really have had my head in the sand, like anybody, the entry level for really kick-ass graphics has changed, and I don't even know anything about that yet, so... Mm-hmm. The idea of being able to network, hopefully, with people who, I'm trying to cut my teeth as a storyteller. People who are trying to cut their teeth as getting some CGI work in their portfolio. You should give me a ring because we could do something. But yeah, that would be the way to do it: is to actually get some special effects artists and do like what they're doing with that Star Trek show, where they're actually continuing the story in some way with huge. But I don't know where they get their money. Mm-hmm. Got to have some trust fund babies around. But
well, I know that. My I usually don't watch anything until someone, unless I know what's going on, or until someone sends me a link. And that's usually when I go, oh, okay, I'll watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes I'll see something. Like, apparently someone has something on Adam Films where an individual remixed the original Shining and made it into a comedy or something.
Yeah, and it's actually quite hilarious. They made it into a romantic comedy, and it's quite hilarious.
The whole movie, or just like...
No, they do a trailer, and they cut it, and they put different music behind it, and they arrange... It's all actual footage, but it's just been arranged to make it seem like it's this heartwarming father-son story or something like that.
Well, and they also made Sleepless in Seattle a stalker film.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's pretty great.
There's a whole remix culture there just waiting to be exploited.
But to your point, you know, you wait...
I had a point?
Well, to what you just said, whether or not it had a point, the notion that you wait to watch stuff until somebody sends it to you.
Yep.
So the primary way that I find out about music right now is I follow about 25 other MP3 blogs that I think are doing stuff that's unique or relevant. And so it's a combination of, you know, unlike relying on Last.fm or just a pure recommendation engine to push me stuff, that because I when that happened, when they do that, it tends to be continue to be too similar to what I already know. I'm craving a kind of novelty or a surprise experience. And so if I subscribe to 25 blogs, I'm going to run across music that I don't like, but a good percentage of that tends to be stuff that I find myself surprised by and I'm enjoying. So in the video blog world, I haven't found anybody yet that's trying to curate and push, you know, take that meta step out and say, I'm going to watch... Nick Denton needs to do this. Put somebody down and say, watch everything in this category and then tell people about the cool stuff and build an audience that way. Because I just want to rely on tastemakers. I don't necessarily want to rely on technology.
Gawker does, what is it, screen?
Gawker does screenhead. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's internet tidbit. It's like Milk and Cookies, Jackson's site.
Jack, you know Milk and Cookies?
Yeah, Jackson Brooks. He's one of our...
Is he in town?
Yeah, he works
I gotta
for,
meet the guy.
He works for Adobe.
Really? Yeah, I gotta meet the guy. I love Milk and Cookies.
He's great.
Yeah, I find a lot of their stuff in there just really, like, it's good. It's good stuff. I mean, it's a good filter. As opposed to some of these other sites that just aren't filters at all.
I want to see more of that stuff. I kind of like to see some... Because I don't have a ton of... time to spend, so the personal genre of video blogs, you know, this is a really crass analogy, but to say that it's sort of live journaling, you're in video format, but typically there's a certain real cinema verite quality about the really good stuff in that category. It's just that finding it is difficult for me, and admittedly I probably sound like a snob, and it's more just that I don't have the time to really wait for the gems.
The shoe fits.
Yeah, and also it's that I hate everything and most people, in fact. So I think
I'm still waiting.
When you start with that premise, life becomes really easy and clear.
I'm waiting for the world's first anti-social network to pop up and get funded. I so want to start the world's first anti-social network. That's my dream. That's my end game, is to start that, and then I'm done. Then I can die peacefully.
Excellent.
So I know you don't watch a lot of video blogs, and that's understandable because I really don't have a lot of time to watch the stuff that I record or listen to the stuff that I download. Do you know a few other video bloggers who live in town? Have you had a chance to network with them in person?
No, I haven't met anybody in town. I'm on there's a video blogging mailing list that is, if you're doing video blogging right now, it's really high signal. If you're not, I mean, gets really techy and really, it spans the gamut of very specific technical implementation questions to the broad philosophical, what is video blogging type of stuff. And there's a lot of really smart people there. And that's been the main filter actually for me to find good blogs, is just, this person consistently says smart things. Let's go check out her blog. And sure enough, that there's a little correlation there. That's about the best filter that I have right now. But, I mean, we're in a different... we're not doing personal video blogging, and there isn't necessarily anybody in town who's trying to do episodic storytelling on the internet that I've met. I don't know that it's... even on the internet, per se, I really hunted, and aside from Channel 101, I'm just must be clueless, because I'm not really finding a ton of stuff to compare ourselves to and then trade notes with. But
which isn't to say you're clueless. It just, I think it's the lack of...
the whole scene is emerging still.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, you know, even the people who've been doing it the longest have only been doing it for, you know, a couple years.
Live streaming of The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media and Limelight Networks. Download Windows Media Player 10 to listen to The Chris Perillo Show live every Thursday from 6 to 9 p.m. Pacific, GMT-8.